Call to order the Subcommittee on Redistricting. Thank you for putting up with a little bit of tardiness, members and distinguished guests. Members, this afternoon I wanted to give some microphone time to someone we all know and have worked with, Mr. Peter Watson. We've had a couple conversations over the last couple months, and one specifically last week, and wanted to tap into Mr. Watson's experience in this area and have him help us as we get underway now that we've received the latest batch of census data. So Mr. Watson's prepared, well, I'll let you introduce yourself and what you've prepared, but my sense is it's a little presentation for us. Do we have Mr. Watson's materials in the folder? Okay, so members, we have something to refer to in our folders. And Mr. Watson, if I can just state at the outset, I appreciate you being here, and I think of your physical presence here as an important symbol of the executive and legislative branches working together on this important topic. So thanks for making this happen, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very happy to be here back in room 107. Haven't been here for a while. I am the counsel to the governor and his point person on redistricting, and I have brought a lot of handouts that Mr. Axvig has been kind enough to duplicate, and I see that there are copies here. Do all the members have the full set in their packets? Okay. Well, we'll get going. I have a lot of material here, and I'm going to go through most of it fairly rapidly because I think the preliminary parts of it are not really much in dispute, and I want to spend as much of my time as possible on the part toward the end where we actually get into a set of guidelines, principles, and can talk more deeply about that. Also, because I have written pretty much everything out, and you can read it at your leisure, I don't want to spend any more time than I need to just making that presentation. I would very much like to be responding to your questions as we go along. So right from the very beginning, as you have questions pop up in your mind, please feel free to ask them, and I won't mind a bit.
Mr. Watson, if I can interrupt at the outset here, because I want to say hello to Ms. Murphy, who is taking our materials. But Ms. Murphy, if you plan to stay, I hope you will join us at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'd be very comfortable with that, and look forward to working with you and the House down the road on this issue. Representative Murphy's the minority lead on this in the similar committee over in the House. So,
thank you.
We'll make you comfortable here.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, as you can see from the handout and from my first slide, I'm going to talk about who wants guidelines, the disadvantages and advantages of having guidelines, who has used what guidelines before, and then how do they work. And the how do they work part is primarily going to focus on Minnesota's guidelines and how they have operated over the last three or four decades to help Minnesota establish its legislative and congressional districts. Well, first of all, who wants guidelines? Well, it's primarily people who are not drawing plans, people who are outsiders, outside the process, could be members of the minority in each body, the minority on the committee. It could even be members of the majority, rank-and-file members who are not lucky enough to sit on this committee or be a part of leadership actually drawing the plans. But even those who are actually drawing the plans may want to have some guidelines if they need to get somebody else's approval. For example, you, Mr. Chairman, may have an interest in getting the approval of the other members of the committee for the plan that you draw. And to the extent that the committee members have bought into a set of principles or guidelines at the beginning of the process, it'll be easier for you to sell your product to them. Likewise, with other members on the floor, once this bill comes out of committee, if the members of the whole Senate have subscribed to the guidelines or principles that you're following, it'll make it a little easier to sell the particular plans that you have. If you have to work with another body, like the House of Representatives, and they have bought into those principles, that will help the process. And if the governor is supportive of the principles, the guidelines that you're working on, that can help the process as well. And finally, if you anticipate that maybe someday you might be in a court because the legislative process has not been successful, it would probably be good if the guidelines that you're following in putting together your bills in this committee are somewhat similar to the guidelines that a court will impose on the parties who submit plans to it, because there's no point in presenting to a court a plan that is outside the realm of what the court might consider. There are disadvantages. The first and most obvious disadvantage is that guidelines tend to tie your hands. And then if you have them but don't follow them, you're going to look bad. It may be politically embarrassing because you're accused of being a hypocrite for not following your own guidelines, but it also may provide grounds for opponents of your plan to mount a legal attack against it. Now, there are advantages, one of which is that as you're putting a plan together, you can, if you've had this preliminary discussion on what's supposed to be in a plan, what are the bounds that you must live within, it'll make it easier for the drafters to put together a plan that fits within legal limits. It may help to narrow the range of disputes over a particular plan and help you to survive legal challenges. And finally, it'll help you tell when you've gotten to yes. If you say that your population deviation limit is 2% or 1%, once you've got your districts down into that range, then you know you've done as much as you need to do to get to yes, and you can move on to some of the other issues that in some cases are actually more pressing. Taking a look at what others have done in past decades, I like to divide them into different categories. We have, first of all, limits on gerrymanders, and I'll have a slide and a handout for that. Limits on gerrymanders generally. Then we have districting principles for plans that were drawn in the last decade. And then there's a third kind that I call procedural guidelines for how you put a plan together. And we'll get to that right at the very end of this presentation. For limits on gerrymanders, I divided them into four categories. And if you've got the handout, the landscape handout, take a look at that, and you'll see I've got them divided into those four different categories, showing of the 50 states, which states have what kind of limits on gerrymanders in addition to their districting principles. You see, there are limits on who draws the plans, limits on the data that may be used in putting a plan together, requirements that a plan be reviewed by somebody else beyond the plan drafter, and then limits on the districts that result. Looking at those limits on data, common ones include no party registration information, no election results, no socio or economic data, and no incumbent residences. And the states that have those prohibitions are primarily states that have commissions drawing their plans. That would be true of Montana and Nebraska, Arizona, California. It's also true of Iowa. Iowa, you probably have heard, has an unusual system where their plans are drawn by their legislative staff, but they are required to be blind to party information and socioeconomic data and where incumbents live. They only have the raw Census Bureau population data when they're drawing their maps. Procedural limits include requiring public hearings. Again, these limits come mostly from the commission states, constitutional amendments that require a commission to draw a plan. Public hearings, preliminary plans before a final plan is produced, and then judicial review. There are three states that require their Supreme Court to review a plan before it goes into effect. The limits on the districts that result are shown in Table 8. That's the portrait-oriented table. And this, again, is the 50 states and showing what each of them used in the last decade as the principles guiding their plans. This one does not say anything about population equality because that applies to all of the 50 states. You'll see that a lot of states require that the territory be compact, and there are 36 states who do that. 48 require them to be composed of contiguous territory, everybody except Rhode Island and one other state, Arkansas, require them to be contiguous. Most states require that...
Mr. Watson?
Yes, sir.
Question from Senator Rest.
And when you say that states require them, those are statutory requirements, constitutional requirements. Where's the authority for the requirements?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, some of each. It's often in a constitution. It may be a statute, or it may be guidelines that the legislature has adopted, or in some case, they are guidelines, criteria, principles that courts have imposed.
Thank you.
Mr. Watson.
And if a little less than half the states require that communities of interest be preserved. Some states require preserving the cores of prior districts, that incumbents be protected, that minorities be fairly represented. Now, representing minorities fairly is a requirement of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2. You cannot discriminate against minorities under certain conditions anywhere in the 50 states. But in addition to that, a number of states have put something into their redistricting guidelines talking about protection of minorities. There are just two states that require that districts be politically competitive. That would be Arizona. That's a constitutional provision. And the other would be Wisconsin, which has a statute requiring political competitiveness. And there are 17 states that require the House district to be nested within the Senate districts like Minnesota does. It's really easy if the districts don't have to be nested because the House draws the House plan, the Senate draws the Senate plan, each one votes for the other. Everybody is happy. It's really quite sweet. But we don't have it that easy here. So how do they work? Taking a look at Minnesota, we do have districting principles, and the next two handouts really go together. I've got this summary of districting principles, and then I've got a set of sample pages from plan reports that were used by the LCC for the plans that were produced last decade, and these reports are in our Maptitude software for use this decade as well. And I'm going to talk about them all together. So we've got the districting principles, the reports, and then the procedural guidelines. And this discussion is about Senate File 182. That's the bill that passed Senator Rest's committee in 2009, passed the whole Senate in 2009. There's some members of this committee who voted for that bill, did not become a law because it never got an author in the House. But it had a convenient set of principles in it that I had summarized at the time and sort of brought that up to date for use this summer and fall. So now, in this case, it sets the number of districts. You all know that Minnesota is unusual among the 50 states in that it does not set the size of its Senate and House by constitution. It's just a statute. So anytime you pass a redistricting bill, you can change the number of members. So if you want to have a different number of members of the Senate, you can do that this year. It's a convenient time. But if you're going to change that, you probably want to do that more near the front of the process than at the tail end of the process. Let people know how many districts you're going to be working with. The nesting requirement, population equality. I think most of you know that Minnesota has been using a deviation of plus or minus 2% since the 1970s. That was what was imposed by the federal court that drew a legislative plan in 1972. And you probably also know, I think, from your previous discussion from Mr. Bodern, that the U.S. Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, would allow you to go up to pretty much a plus or minus 5%. But our court, when drawing plans for the first time in 72, too, said, well, we're not like a legislature. We don't have that freedom to deviate from perfect equality for political reasons, because we want to keep particular communities together or we want to preserve particular subdivisions. We're going to have to be more focused on population equality. So for ourselves, we will impose a 2% plus or minus deviation. And that is held through the last decade as well. The congressional standard of as equal in population as practicable used to mean 1,000 people maybe, or 1%. I think in, was it 1981, the court said we'll have a standard for congressional plans of 0.25%. But in 1983, the U.S. Supreme Court in Karcher versus Daggett said, no, we're not talking about plus or minus anything. We're talking about as equal as you can get. And if you're going to have any deviation from mathematical equality, you have to justify that deviation in every district and by some consistent principles, such as not dividing precincts. There are a number of states that work with whole precincts in building their congressional plans, and that has withstood court scrutiny because they're being consistent. There are some states like Iowa and Arkansas and West Virginia have used whole counties, and they've had a larger deviation with their congressional districts. The courts have said, that's okay, you're being consistent, you've got a principle. But in most of the states, they have followed the as equal as mathematically possible, and so, 10 or 18 to 20 states have come with either as one person or no more than 10 people in their deviations. This population summary report, which is the first one on the list, is designed to tease out from your data those important numbers. And it shows right up here at the top the overall range. And what the court achieved 10 years ago was an overall range of 1.35%. You could see it was plus 0.73 and minus 0.61. So that was substantially better than the 2% limit that they had imposed on themselves. They did better than what they told themselves they had to do. But that's right up there at the top. You can see it first thing, and then all of the individual districts are down below. So they're not going to be fooling anybody about what your deviations are. It's going to be obvious to see. Contiguity and compactness. The Minnesota Constitution says, and I think, again, Mr. Bonner probably told you this at your last meeting, that the Senate districts must be composed of convenient, contiguous territory. It's not a limit on House districts. It's not a limit on congressional districts. But when the federal courts and later the state courts were drawing congressional districts, they said, let's make the congressional districts of convenient, contiguous territory. And they also said they must be compact, structured into compact units.
Senator Rest.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, is it okay to ask questions about the contiguity and compactness?
I think that would be just fine. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, over the last decade, there have been, in the areas that have seen a lot of growth, a lot of annexation, and which has produced non-contiguous parcels in cities, growing cities, where part of an area was annexed, but there might be a hole in the city that is still township property. And I'm looking in particular this afternoon at Little Falls, which has all kinds of holes in it from its annexation. And we know that it happened in St. Cloud. It's happened in Rochester, Sauk Rapids, Wright County. I don't know why they couldn't annex contiguously, but for whatever reason and whatever their wisdom were, they didn't do that. Do you have any advice or observations to make about whether, in order to have compactness. We are forced into some sort of discontinuity, or if we want to include these little township areas, does that mean we have to include the whole township as a, you know, talking about a community of interest? And it's my impression, and I may be wrong, you can correct me, that in 2000, that was not as much of an issue. But these are, I'm assuming, orderly annexations, but that show the growth of cities, and they are, they look like Swiss cheese. Do you have any comment on that, or any guidance for us in making, in dealing with those growth areas that the city has got inside it, portions, totally surrounds portions of townships?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I do in two or three different ways. One is, having seen the cities go crazy with their non-contiguous annexations over the past decade, and I think more so than in previous decades, there must be something wrong with our municipal annexation law that is letting that happen. And I'm not up to date on what that is.
We are not going to have annexation hearings to change the law. Let me tell you, we've tried that, and it's all-out war. Not going to happen.
Mr. Watts.
Yes, I agree, Senator Rest. That all-out war has caused the problem. So what do you do with the problem? You have responsibility to make your best political judgments as to what to do in each individual situation. But as a general approach, what we did 10 years ago was say, recognize those areas where there is a township surrounding a city, and there are little pockets of the city throughout the township, and start there. Start by putting the city and the township into the same district. You take the whole township and just think of them as a unit, and then build around them rather than trying to divide the township from the city. And when you do that, you will find that your district boundaries are more regular, and you reduce the number of times that you have to divide a township or divide a city. Because otherwise you do get into dividing the one or the other, and it would be better if you could avoid that. And the way to avoid that is just start by putting them together and build the rest of your district around situations like that. There are not that many, few dozen, where that occurs. And it is possible to get around that using the method that I suggested.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
If you have a set of redistricting principles, however, and Mr. Chairman, at some point I'd like to hand out the copies of that concurrent resolution I put in last Thursday, and you don't set priorities for what those principles are, don't you have compactness and continuity and whatever in tension with one another, or saying that compactness is a better guideline? Is a better guideline than continuity or any of the others. If you say, well, just put all the township parcels into a district where the city has otherwise annexed the property.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that is what makes redistricting so difficult. You have competing priorities. And it's not always possible to say that one is going to outrank another. However, with some of them, you can do that, because you know that contiguity is a constitutional requirement, and preserving the boundaries of political subdivisions may be a statutory requirement in Minnesota. It is not a constitutional requirement.
I just think it's going to be, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you're finding it the case, too. It's going to be a real challenge.
A challenge. Thank you, Senator Rest. Thank you, Mr. Watson. Please continue.
So you see that line about structured into compact units. Our Constitution, talking about convenient contiguous territory, it's kind of hard to do a mathematical assessment of whether a district is convenient or not. That again, is calling upon the committee and others to make a subjective judgment. But if you say that the districts have to be compact, there are various mathematical measurements of compactness. And these next two reports, one shows three different measures of compactness. And I think in the current software, there's about eight different measures of compactness you can try. And no one of them is particularly ideal. But if you take a bunch of them and look at them and look at a bunch of plans, you can get an idea who's doing a little bit better on compactness. And then there is the contiguity report that will show you whether you have any units that are not contiguous. Now, these particular principles say that point contiguity is not permitted unless it's within the same municipality. And you're probably asking yourselves, what is point contiguity? That's point contiguity. This is the city of Dilworth up by Moorhead, and that one little piece up in the northern part is contiguous only at a corner. That's called corner-to-corner contiguity. And if you say that point contiguity is not permitted, then that would not be permitted to be the shape of a district. But there are other kinds of point contiguity besides corner-to-corner, and this is an example of one. This is the city of Lynd down by Marshall, where it just touches at a point. Again, it's all part of the same city. Numbering. The Constitution says that the districts, Senate districts, shall be numbered in a regular series, whatever that might be. And since the 1990s, there has been a principle that sets forth what the numbering scheme is, with the legislative districts starting in the northwest and going from west to east and north to south, and the congressional districts doing the opposite, starting in the southeast and working their way up to the northwest and the northeast. And with the legislative districts, they've always skipped the metropolitan area and then come back and do the metropolitan area and then finish up in Minneapolis and St. Paul. This principle would say finish up in Hennepin County and Ramsey County, which puts all of the districts in each of those counties in sequence. So you look at the numbers and say these five or eight or whatever are in Ramsey and these 14 or whatever the number is are all in Hennepin. Minority representation. The Voting Rights Act says that you can't be diluting the voting strength of a racial or language minority if that minority is sufficiently large and geographically compact to constitute a majority if given a single member district, and if the minority is politically cohesive, that is, they tend to vote for the same candidate, and third, that the block voting by a white majority usually defeats the minority's preferred candidate. Those are called the three preconditions, and they come from a case called Thornburg versus Jingles from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986. If you get past those three preconditions, then a plaintiff needs to be able to show that there is a history of discrimination in the area against that minority group. And if they can show the three preconditions and a history of discrimination, then the plan drafters have an obligation to draw a plan that majority has a fair chance to win. The federal court in, I think it was 1981, when they put their principles together, said, we want to go further than that. 81 is actually a year before the Voting Rights Act was amended. And we're going to require that our plans draw a district that a minority population has a fair chance to win, regardless of whether there's that history of discrimination. We're just going to look at if the population is sufficiently large and geographically compact to draw a minority district, we're going to do it. And that affirmative obligation was continued in the 1990s. It was continued in the legislative resolutions of 2001, but was not included in the court's principles adopted at the end of 2001. To get at the minority populations and what's possible, there is this minority report. You see a sample of it. And what it does is it looks for any district that has 30% or more total minority population and then puts that in a little table up at the top. And then you can take a look, and it ranks them in the order of their total minority population. And you can take a look then at those districts and see whether, if maybe you did some jiggering, you could get a district where a minority had a majority of the population or not. And then all of the districts are shown in the remainder of the report. So it will soon appear whether you can draw majority-minority districts or not. You draw some plans and run that report. Preserving political subdivisions. As I said, 44 states have some requirement for preserving political subdivisions. And in Minnesota since, 1991, we have identified what those political subdivisions are. It's not watershed districts. It's not hospital districts. It's not school districts. It's just counties, cities, and towns. Those should be kept together when possible. And if you're going to divide a county, a city, or a town, you must divide it into as few districts as possible. Poor Blaine, are they currently divided into 5 Senate districts? There are some cities that have kind of taken it hard because you divide it once and then you say, well, we divided them one, let's divide them a whole bunch of times. But that principle is designed to get at that. And then you have the political subdivision splits report, which shows, again, right up at the top, how many counties, an MCD is a city or a town, and a VTD is a precinct, how many of those have been divided in the plan. And then down a little below, it shows the number of times they have been divided. There's also a little table that shows ones where the split doesn't involve any people, and you're not harming anybody. Communities of interest, I like to say, are the essay question in redistricting, because a community of interest is whatever you can think up. Now, in Minnesota, we have talked about communities of interest including neighborhoods in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Indian reservations throughout the state, school districts sometimes, rural areas, the mining areas, forest areas, whatever you want to call as a community of interest. But it needs to have a geographical dimension. It can't just be an intellectual community. It needs to be something that you can map on the ground. And each decade, people try to articulate what they mean by a community of interest. And what you see in this, what passed the Senate File 182, is a statement of social, political, cultural, ethnic, or economic interests, or linked by transportation or communication. Well, how do you know if you've preserved a community of interest or not? Well, you have a communities of interest report. You can put a layer into your geography for neighborhoods or Indian reservations or school districts, and you can run this report that will show the number that are split and the percentage of population that has gone into each. And this particular community of interest report is on the current districts, that it was districts from 2000 that were split by the districts of 2002. In other words, Senator Stumpf was in District 1, and his old District 1, 80% of its population was in his new District 1, 20% were people who are new to him and down the list. So you can see how much was it preserved. And actually, there's a more sophisticated version of this that works with voting age population and also gives you a little total up here. What percent? 60%, 70% of the cores of prior districts were preserved. Then we get to political competitiveness. And you, those who were around 10 years ago, will remember how devoted Governor Ventura was to the concept of making districts competitive. And he appointed a governor's citizen commission on redistricting and tasked them with coming up with a way to measure political competitiveness. And with the help of their staff person, Joe Mansky, they came up with a measure. And they said, well, we're going to have to have a partisan index, and what will that be? They said, we will take the minor constitutional officers at the last statewide election, and we'll add them all together for Democrats, for Republicans, and for other, for third party. We'll add them up. That'll be our partisan index votes. And then we'll take a look at in each district who has a plurality, and we'll take a look at the difference between the Republican and Democratic vote, and we'll say that if the difference is no more than 8% was the number they pulled out of the air, that was a competitive district. So it's some place between 46 and 54%, that was, in their definition, a competitive district. So I worked with Caliper Corporations, the maker of Maptitude, to come up with a report that would measure that, and you see it here. That in this plan, this is the one that the court adopted 10 years ago, the one that you've been running on for the last decade. There were 27 districts that were rated competitive, and you'll see that there were six Democratic districts that were over 54% and two that were over 60%.
So Mr. Watson, just so I understand that, so the judicial plan, which came out in March of 2002, when you run it on against the Ventura Commission's competitiveness guidelines, it only spit out 27 districts that were considered competitive out of 67.
Mr. Chairman, that is true. And in a moment, I'll show you some statistics that show how the court did in comparison with a plan drawn up by the Ventura Commission and the plans passed by the Senate and the House.
Thank you.
And I think you'll find it interesting. Then there is incumbents. And for quite some time, there has been an interest in having districts that were not drawn either to protect or to defeat an incumbent. And as you all know, the easiest way to defeat an incumbent is to put two incumbents together so that at least one of them will lose. It's called pairing incumbents. And to see whether a plan pairs incumbents or not, there is the incumbents report. And with three different kinds of brackets, it shows whether the incumbents paired are Republicans or Democrats or one of each. And you see the brackets on this first page. And then you'll see at the top that in the court's plan, there were 18 incumbents paired. There were 9 open seats. And 2 of the pairs were Democrat-Democrat, 3 were Republican-Republican, and 4 were Republican-Democrat. Now, the court said that they were not going to draw a plan, and they didn't want parties submitting to them a plan that was drawn either to protect or defeat an incumbent. And they said that after they'd drawn their plan, they would take a look. They were not going to be starting with the knowledge of incumbent residences. But at the end, they were going to take a look and try to make sure that they were not unduly either pairing or protecting incumbents. And this is how they came up. And again, we'll take a look and see how their plan compared with the other plans. This particular bill, Senate File 182, did impose a numerical order. It said, put them in priority order in the way they are listed in this section, unless to do so would violate either federal or state law. I think, Senator Esch, your committee gave some consideration to that before passing the bill in 2009. Those procedural guidelines I was talking about. Maybe I should get into this last page before I talk about the procedure.
Hang on, Mr. Watson. I've sent a rest on that last slide.
Mr. Chairman, just with regard to the last two principles in the districting guideline resolution that I submitted, it is silent with regard to political competitiveness, and it does not put the the principles in any priority order. 10 years ago, there was not agreement between the House and the Senate about including competitiveness, and I thought we might have that same argument again, and so did not include it, although Senator Pogemiller did have it, and Mr. Watson pointed out both of those. There were 11 instead of 9, I believe the number is, and that was the bill that passed the Senate. And as I understand it, Mr. Watson, the courts in that March 2002 ruling did not really deal with competitiveness, although they talked about it and mentioned it, but it wasn't a core principle that they used, as I recall.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I believe you are correct that they did not identify that as one of their principles.
Yes. Yep. And so I also chose not to put that in this resolution.
Mr. Watson.
I wanted to turn to this last one in the handout of the reports, because what it does is take a bunch of plans, 7 different plans that were considered during the last decade, and show how they stack up on these various measures. So you get an idea of what's a good plan and what's not such a good plan. And I think you'll see that they tend to converge, that they're not all that different one from another, even though they may have come from a different house or a different political party, a different plaintiff. They're not all that far apart, any of them. And in particular, or you could just take a quick look at the numbers across there, but I was going to call your attention to, I think it's about the last page on the political competitiveness and the incumbent pairs.
Yep, so it's the very last page of our handout that has been stapled together, members, the very last side.
You see, the state court and the Senate have 9 pairs. That's 18 members, which seems like a lot of members. But the Senate's own plan had 8 pairs, 16 members. So it's not as though the court was being outrageous in pairing 18 members. The House paired only 14 senators. Isn't that nice? But the Ventura plan would have paired 20. 10 times 2 is 20. The same kind of thing you'll see with the House members, that the court plan had 17 pairs, 34 members, which is it's more than the House had. 8 pairs, 16 members, a lot more than the House, but not as many as the Ventura plan. How competitive did they get? Well, you'd think there might be a huge range, but you take a look in the Senate districts. They started with a plan, the 2000 plan that was used in the previous election, that had 28 competitive districts. And the court ended up with one that it's 27. But the Ventura plan, boy, they were going to do competitive. That was number one. They get up to 30, which is really not that different from 27. Part of my point is that you don't get to know what's a good plan until you've seen a lot of plans. You see what's possible given the territory. given the configuration of Minnesota, where the population is, the shape of the districts and so forth, how things are distributed, where people happen to live. Now, maybe the pairings this decade will be quite different from last decade, but that may be just because the people happen to live in different relationship to each other. I know there are an awful lot of House members who live really close to each other. There are going to be a lot of pairs in the House plan. I don't know whether they'll be more than 10 years ago. We won't know until we start drawing a few plans. Are there questions about this?
Members, I'd like to spend a little more time with Mr. Watson on his presentation, and then we have Mr. Gillespie to talk about what we received from the Census Bureau in the last couple days here. And then I also want to give Senator Rest a moment or two to talk about the resolution and the principles that follow on to what Mr. Watson was talking about. So any...
Mr. Chairman, moving forward with these procedural guidelines, these were guidelines that were in a joint resolution that was passed by the Senate in 2001. The House passed a similar version. They went to conference committee and never did reach agreement. It didn't say anything about public hearings or preliminary plans or judicial review, presumably because these are plans being passed by the legislature, which will do what it wants in that regard. But the procedural guidelines required that the data used be the Public Law 94-171 census data. That's what we got yesterday, as modified by the GIS office if necessary. And you should all know that the data that comes straight from Tiger, from the Census Bureau, is different. You get different totals from the totals you're going to see with the system that the GIS office is using. And we can go into that at some other time. But the population counts at the block level are all the same. And I think they're close at the precinct level. But at the MCD, the city and town level, they get to be different because the Census Bureau used boundaries as of January 1, 2010. And the GIS office is using boundaries for precincts as of the November election last fall. So all the changes that occurred during 2010 were not picked up by the Census Bureau. They were picked up by the GIS office. So I think that you'll see that those precinct boundaries are accurate, and they are different from the Census Bureau boundaries, which are old. And then that reflects up in the populations of the cities and towns. Plans could not be submitted until the database had been verified as ready for use. Mr. Melier has to take a look at the data, scrub it, make sure it's okay, put it out on the web for everybody to use, and then he would, under these principles, send a message to the presiding officer saying, go, it's ready for use. And the requirement 10 years ago was that people... before a plan would be submitted to a committee or on the floor, it had to be submitted to the GIS office. It's called a block equivalency file. It's just all several hundred thousand blocks in the state indicating what district they're in, and then the GIS office builds maps and reports from that, and they get posted on the web. So that's that little plug for the map that's on the GIS site of the 50 states with a link to each that will show the principles used by each of the 50 states. Then you should have in your map, I'm going to segue here into what Tom is going to tell you about. You should have in your packets the little table of population Senate seats showing the population and the number of Senate seats for various large units of geography like the metro area and the major counties, and how they have changed from 1990 to 2000 to 2010, and how that's reflected in the number of Senate seats. You'll see we've got about a half a Senate seat more in the metro area this decade than last decade and on down. And you'll see the percentage growth. And Mr. Gillespie is going to have more on that. Then you should also have in your packets a smaller version of this little map. And the little map has on it Mr. Gillespie's numbers for the population deviation of each district that shows how far out of population balance each district is. So you can see who's next to whom. Who's going to have to grow in area because their population is a negative, and who's going to have to shrink in area because their population deviation is a positive. It's a quick way to see where the pressure points are going to be. When people who are neighbors, they used to be friends, but they're going to be fighting over territory over the next several weeks, and we hope it doesn't sour their friendship. So I hope that is enlightening for you, and I'll turn the podium over to Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Watson, before we lose you, any more general advice or counsel from the governor's office? How you've indicated publicly you're going to be the point person. I appreciate some of the governor's comments talking about it. It sounds like he's going to let the legislative branch do its work. He has made some other comments appearing to be warm to a commission, an independent commission at times. So whether you choose to do so now or in the near future, I hope you will be a conduit for us to work with the governor. And would you like to produce something that is agreeable to him?
Let's stay in touch.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Mr. Gillespie, could you join us? Mr. Gillespie, I know that the last 2 days have probably been busy for you. You knew it was coming, and it finally came. And so maybe just a general overview from you as to what we got, anything that you think we should take special note of as we begin to be able to dig in now.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Minnesota Department of Administration. You should have in your packet as well two tables. One shows the population counts for Minnesota's congressional districts. That is the total population count by district, the deviation from equal population. And I also computed the percent of minority persons in the district, and then a similar table for each of the 67 Minnesota Senate districts, and again the same characteristics. We have of course talked at some length about the expected changes, and to a large extent the expected changes in congressional districts were borne out. The two largest districts by a substantial margin are District 6, Congressman Bachman's district, and District 2, Congressman Klein's districts, both of which are substantially larger than the equal population size. The smallest districts are districts 4 and 5, Congressman McCollum and Congressman Ellison, and also District 7 on the west western portion of the state, Congressman Peterson. Actually, District 8 was slightly closer than I had anticipated to the equal population total. We had estimated that it would not be too far off, but it was a little bit closer than anticipated. And District 3 was a bit further away. We knew it was going to be fairly close, but it's a little less close than we were anticipating, but still a modest difference from the equal population size. Two of the districts, the districts 4 and 5, have minority representation of greater than 30%. By Senate district, the The smallest districts are largely in, as we anticipated, in the northwest, southwest, and northeast portions of the state. The smallest district is District 20 in the southwestern portion of the state, including the counties of Big Stone, Swift, Lacaparral, Yellow Medicine, and Renville and Lincoln counties. The largest district is District 35 in the Southwest Metro area in Scott County, including the cities of Shakopee and Prior Lake and Savage as the primary components of that district. The difference between the largest and smallest Senate districts was 41,748 people, approximately two-thirds of a Senate district. So fairly substantial difference between the smallest and the largest. The largest districts tend to be in the growth donut around the Twin Cities, particularly in the Scott and Carver County area, the Isanti and Chisago County areas, and in the Wright Sherburne County, and also in the southern part of Mille Lacs County, tend to be the largest districts in the state. We also received information on minority populations by race and ethnicity, and there is as anticipated, we expected to see large changes. Minnesota, by comparison, is not an especially diverse state, but we are changing and becoming increasingly diverse. Over the last decade, more than 80% of our total population growth was in minority persons, with the largest increases occurring in the Hispanic or Latino population, and also the Black or African American and the Asian populations grew very strongly, as did the population of people with more than one race. We now have eight state Senate districts with more than 30% minority populations in the districts. With that, that's pretty much all we received yesterday, was total population and by very detailed area, and it's a matter of slodging through and double checking, make sure that the boundaries are up to date, and that the municipal boundaries, things like that, are the most recent that we have. As Mr. Watson pointed out, that there is a timing difference between our most updated information and what the Census Bureau has, and Mr. Millier will be working on that, and will be assisting with that.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gillespie, based on the experience in 2001 and 2002, what is the incidence of error in the information that is then subsequently corrected?
Mr. Gillespie.
I think, and I'll explain that. So I think some of us have looked at some of the numbers and just have a real question mark about, well, that really seems way off from what maybe the 2009 estimates were or something. And how accurate is the data that is transmitted to us, and where do we generally find mistakes when mistakes are made? And I'm assuming that because it's so much data there are mistakes occasionally.
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the largest differences tend to be in boundary issues, and there part of that is a timing issue, but also the boundaries are quite detailed. They do change on a fairly consistent basis, and there are almost always some issues concerning boundaries. We will be double checking that. We've already identified one. It doesn't really involve people, but a boundary issue with Le Sueur City, and there's a bit of land that shouldn't be in the next county that is. We thought we had corrected that with the Census Bureau, and the correction didn't happen. So we are we will be checking that sort of thing, and you know, it's a lot of detail. There will be a process starting at the approximately the beginning of the fiscal year and lasting for 2 years, called the CQR, or account question resolution process, that local units of government have an opportunity to question census results. We will be working with communities and encouraging and even identifying communities and making those corrections. We did find a number of those issues. Most of them had to do with boundary issues, and we were able to correct most of those. We had a couple cities that didn't apparently read our letters and our request to found the problem in after it was too late. There were a couple of instances where there were actual count issues that came up that could not be corrected. One example that was one of the more egregious ones was a college dorm at Mankato, or Morehead State University. One of the dorms was not counted till apparently June, and well, not surprising, there weren't many people there. The correction this time for that was that in cooperation with the Census Bureau, one of my staff people was deputized with the Census Bureau and went to Washington and checked to make sure that they included all of the group facilities including college dorms, nursing homes, institutions, group homes, anything like that. And we do have records from the Department of Health and others that we maintain this database on a consistent basis, and we were able to identify potential errors and potential issues while the field staff was still in the field that could be corrected. Now, one difference that you may be seeing in terms of the difference between the 2009 estimate and the actual final count is that within the larger cities, we are not able to subdivide our estimates within the city. So, for example, Minneapolis, there are a number of districts within Minneapolis that we weren't able to subdivide. So we basically make an estimate that's sort of an averaged estimate for all the districts within that area, knowing full well that there are differences. And as it turns out, one of the five smallest districts was in that area, in the downtown Minneapolis area, that we had sort of averaged out as being somewhat low, but not one of the lowest. So that was more likely an estimating issue, that we know about, but have no way of subdividing further than we have.
Thank you.
Other questions, members, for Mr. Gillespie or Mr. Watson, who's stayed with us? Senator Rest, I don't know if you're prepared a full presentation, but let's at least take a few minutes. I know you've put some work into this, and I appreciate you kind of leading off the principles discussion here. Thank you, Mr. Gillespie, and thank you, Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman and members, I
Senator
did bring
Rest.
Copies of the Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 5, which does speak to the redistricting principles that were in the Senate file that we passed in the previous biennium, and that also reflects the redistricting principles that we saw in the court decision March of 2002, and they're pretty plain vanilla. I mean, there nothing startling in them. We have had them before. The two that I left out that were on that were in Senator Pogemiller's bill was putting them in order of priority. And I think we had a discussion from Mr. Watson when I was asking the questions about compactness and contiguity. When you start doing that, then you have, for some of them that are the thorniest issues, you have a tension that perhaps we don't want. And, I mean, it's easy to say that, like the first principle, number of districts should be a certain number. I've used the number that we've had before. We've had bills in the Senate that have reduced the number of Senate districts to make them nest inside a congressional district, for example, Senator Olson's bill. And you could certainly put those in a priority order. But the thorniest ones, I think, are not the ones we don't want, or I thought that a priority ordering there was maybe just not called for because of the, particularly the contiguity and compactness. And then recalling that competitiveness was certainly something that Governor Ventura was interested in, but the courts did not use that as a guiding principle, although they looked at the information. So I decided that we could do without that as well. And things that people may have different ideas about are indeed if you wanted to have something other than 67 districts. Senator Olson's bill had 64. What I do not think is to the advantage of the Senate as an institution is to set up a system by which we would have a tie. 32-32 is not a good result, and that kind of divided government, I think, is not something that recommends it. They have that in the House because, of course, they're just double what we are, and that has happened at least once or twice, and I'm not sure that it was satisfactory to either party at the time. They have since, I don't know exactly when that was. Was that 78? 79, yes. The election of 78. The majorities have been very close since then, like 68, 66, in 1985, but I don't think that the Senate needs to embrace that kind of dilemma. The other issue would be one is in the third principle, not the one that talks about totally or absolutely equal except with a remainder. For congressional districts, but what is the best deviation level? And there's been discussion, I think, over the years. We've used 2%, and that's been kind of standard, but some have argued for a lesser percentage deviation, and I think we have, I don't have the report from the court decision, but I think we strived, even though we allowed ourselves 2% in 2002, I think we strived to make it less than that. And I think the court did the same. But you can have that as a principle consider, you know, what are the advantages, disadvantages? Is there a partisan advantage or disadvantage of having a lesser percentage? And that's probably... Or good government argument for having less of a percentage than 2%. But in general, it's my understanding that it was done in order to truly acknowledge where you don't have to do that on the congressional districts, the communities of interest. You do not want to divide a township of 100 people into two Senate districts. You'd rather have the deviation allow that particular township to be all in a single Senate district. So I just offer this to the Senate and to you, Mr. Chairman, and would I don't know what your plans are for officially considering it, and or whether and that would be my question, if you yourself are going to this particular concurrent resolution certainly has spots for Republicans to support it. Right now it's the three DFL members that are on it, or whether you are yourself going to propose a resolution to set some principles. Mr. Watson talked about the advantages and disadvantages, and you know, that's certainly something to talk about as well. Mm-hmm. I had it drafted as a concurrent resolution, which means that it's a Senate concurrent resolution, Representative Murphy. If it passed the Senate, it would then go to the House, and they could choose to either act on it or not act on it. It is not, however, a resolution that goes to the governor. This is simply a sense of the Senate and a sense of the House if it passed here. So it is not a joint resolution, which would mean there would be both green jackets and yellow jackets and would have to go to the governor. There's been a lot of discussion about the obligation of the legislature, constitutional obligation, and it seemed to me that at this time to do the mapping and the proposals, and so it seemed to me to be most appropriate then to have a resolution to be a resolution as the sense of in the first instance of the Senate.
And on that, Senator Est, so your conclusion at this point is that you'd rather kind of keep this in the legislative branch, this
yes
kind of outline, these guidelines, these principles. Are you opposed to trying
joint
to
resolution?
To include the governor in this?
I'm not opposed to it. It just seemed to me that it spoke to the again, and we've had discussions about this, to the constitutional obligation, and I guess I could have gone either way, but this seemed to me to be more recognizing separation of powers. That's all.
Understood. I think it's a good start, Senator Rest. I'd like to explore it with the rest of the members of the committee, and then maybe have a little more discussion with the House too, to see if this is something that they'd embrace. Senator Nino, Senator Bach. Yeah. All right then. So, Senator, thank you for doing the work
Sure. Over
the last week and bringing that forward today. Mr. Gillespie and Mr. Watson, thank you again for joining us, and Representative Murphy, nice to see you. We'll
thank
be
you.
Seeing more of you in the next 2 months.
Thank you.
Thank you. Committee's adjourned.